that people generally survive plane crashes. And I was in the airport waiting to leave Columbus, and I wound up talking to this woman who turned out to be the wife of a pastor in Canada. And we were both flying United, and it came up that I watched these documentaries. So I told her about United Flight 232. What happened to that flight is it was a plane that had two wing-mounted engines and a tail-mounted engine, and the tail-mounted engine blew up. Now, the thing about airplanes, why they're so safe, is everything is redundant. Like, there are three different hydraulic lines in every airplane, so if one fails, you can go to the next one, then go to the next one if that fails. This exploding engine severed all three, so they couldn't steer the plane. So the plane, because it's now off kilter, starts to roll this way. And thinking on his feet, the pilot reaches over and guns the right engine, which levels it off, but they can't steer it. So it just so happened that one of the best training pilots for this type of plane was riding as a passenger on that plane. And so he ran up to the cockpit and he started operating the engines and steering it that way. And so they diverted to another airport, and what they did is they corkscrewed down as they lost altitude. And so when they came out of the last corkscrew, I mean, you only get one chance to line this up. If you miss it, it's not like you can corkscrew again. And they came out of it in line with the runway. They couldn't put the wheels down. And they actually put the plane down. 111 people died, but 185 lived, landing a plane that had no steering. And so I was telling this woman this, and you know what she said? She said that that training pilot was on the plane. That's providence. That's God's work. And I thought to myself, if God didn't want 111 people to die, why let the engine explode in the first place? I mean, it's not like engines have free will. God can do whatever he wants to them, right? And that just reminded me why I do what I do. Because religion allows people to look at a tragedy where 111 people die and see God's hand in it and consider God kind rather than culpable. And it just reminded me why I was so happy to be coming here and giving this talk, which is Dear Christian 2. For those of you who saw Dear Christian 1, I wrote Dear Christian 1 after attending a different church every Sunday for a whole year. And I'd go and sit and take notes, and whenever they would stand to sing, I wouldn't stand, and whenever they'd stand to pray, I wouldn't stand. And so then after church, like white blood cells to an infection, they all came up and said, "We haven't seen you here before." I'm like, "Hi, I'm JT, I'm an atheist. Why should I believe any of this?" And so I wrote Dear Christian 1 as a response to all the arguments I would get going to church every Sunday. And there was more that could go into one talk, so I wrote Dear Christian 2. What's up next? A few weeks ago on my blog, I got a comment from a Christian. And she said, "I'm with you. I don't like it when Christians shove Christianity down people's throats. I don't like it when atheists shove their atheism down people's throats." Now, forgetting for a moment that atheists shoving atheism down people's throats is tantamount to "you're wrong," I'm not offended when Christians try to shove their Christianity down my throat. I'm offended by the Christians that don't. I mean, think about it. If you think I'm destined for hell and you're trying to help save me, kudos for you. It's the moderate Christians who believe that I'm destined for hell and who, if I fell down and scraped my knee, would abandon everything in their day to run over and make sure I was okay, but who actually believe that I'm a heartbeat away from eternal torment and who walk by me without a care in the world. It's for Christians like that that I've written this talk. Here's why I care. A lot of times the moderate liberal Christians will say, "Why do you criticize all Christians? Shouldn't you just criticize the bad Christians and not the good Christians?" No. No, and I'll tell you why. If you read the news, every couple months you can read a story of two parents who had a sick child, like this one, Madeline Newman. 11 years old, at one point became incredibly sick, and over a period of 2 weeks developed shallow breathing, skin that turned blue, intense abdominal pain, and eventually she died of diabetes. And everyone in this room knows why. Because during that whole two-week period, never once did her parents pick up the phone and summon an ambulance, because they believed that prayer would help heal her. Now, if the word "bad" is to have any meaningful definition, parents who neglect their child to death are bad. One might even say they're monsters. Now, the moderate Christian would say to me, like, "Why are you telling me this? These are obviously bad Christians. Of course you should criticize them." And I say it because liberal Christians are not that different. because these parents loved their child as much as any moderate or liberal Christian would love their child. They wanted their child to get well as much as any of us would want our child to get well. The problem wasn't, as Christianity would have us believe, that there's something malicious about the human condition that makes us do things like this. The problem was that they had a bad idea about how the universe worked. And once they had that bad idea, all of the good intentions in the world weren't enough to save their daughter. So what does that tell me? It tells me that each and every human being, if they have good intentions, which I think is pretty much everybody, has a moral obligation to do their best to be reasonable about how the world works, to make sure that our good intentions are borne out in reality. And that is where moderate and liberal Christians fail. They fail to be reasonable because their beliefs about someone rising from the dead are no more credible than their beliefs about someone rising from the dead. And by running around saying it's okay to believe in things for bad reasons, it's okay to believe on faith, they are promoting the mechanics that create this style of tragedy. I'm sure they're good people with good intentions, but beliefs are the gatekeepers to actions. And our actions affect everybody around us. They affect our neighbors. They affect me. My beliefs affect my actions, which affect Christians. And that makes my beliefs their business. But it also makes their beliefs my business. And if my neighbors on earth aren't being reasonable, I feel it would be immoral of me not to say anything. And so to the moderate and liberal Christians, that's why I have to attack faith. It's why I have to attack your faith. Now, the thesis of this whole talk is twofold. First, God has abandoned you, even if he exists. He's abandoned me. Consider for a moment the premise of all of Christianity. You have to choose to believe in Jesus. How many of us have heard that one? You have to choose to believe in Jesus. And my position is that that's impossible. I couldn't do it if I wanted to. Our beliefs are not things we choose. They're the product of whatever facts are rattling around our brain, and we're powerless to do otherwise. And if you think I'm off base here, try walking to the edge of the roof of a building and convincing yourself, just by force of will, that gravity doesn't work. There's not a single person in this room who could do it. There's not a single Christian who could do it, because their minds are already made up about gravity. There's nothing they can do to change it. And my mind, without any additional evidence on people rising from the dead, is already made up for me. I couldn't believe it if I wanted to. So why would a God make me with that type of brain, a brain incapable of being changed by force of will, and then make heaven or hell dependent on my ability to accept the absurd? That is the type of God who has abandoned me. He's abandoned everyone who can't believe ludicrous claims without any evidence. The other way God has abandoned Christians in particular is he could have given the Christian every advantage in the argument for his existence, and he didn't. He didn't do it. Consider the arguments you're left with. Consider what the Christian has to do every day. God has left the Christian to defend God's apathy. I mean, moderate or liberal Christians, if I believe you're good people, and if you're as good as I think you are, when you see pictures like this of starving children, your heart sinks. If you were there, you would feed this child. And this is just a picture. There are a million more pictures like this on Google Images. There are a million more children like this in the world. And God doesn't just see their pictures. He sees them. And if one of us was standing in front of a child like that, we would feed them. But God won't. Anytime a Christian donates to feeding the children, they are doing what God has either been unable to do or unwilling to do. And he's left you to defend that. Now, what you'll get from Christians is there's suffering in the world because of free will. God doesn't want to infringe on our free will, and we do things or fail to do things that result in suffering from other people. But there are two things to say about this. The first is things like natural disasters. Hurricanes exist no matter how nice we are to one another. Now, you could argue that, well, we created satellite weather radar, and God gave us the means to do it so we could get people out of the way of hurricanes. But if God didn't want people to die in hurricanes, why make hurricanes in the first place? The other thing to say about the free will argument is that we don't need every option in order to have free will. What do I mean about that? Take this building that we're in, for instance. There are several things
we could do to this building with our free will. We could kick the building. It would hurt. We could paint the building. We could pee on the building. At which point the building owners would use their free will to charge AHA more money. We can't leap over the building. Just can't do it. You can't convert the building into a unicorn with the power of your mind. And if you can, you need to call James Randi. But even though we can't do the last two things, we still have free will. We don't need all of the choices to have free will. We just need some choices. So take the things we can do in a random day. We can pet puppies. We can pray. We can pee on buildings. We can snowboard. And we can have gay sex. Now, even though we don't need all the options in order to have free will, for some reason, that one's still there. Why? I mean, it's not like it even had to be sinful. I mean, because God makes the moral rules, right? I mean, gay sex isn't bad until God says it's bad. It's not like God was stumbling around the cosmos and came across this moral rule he didn't make. No, for some reason, one day, for whatever reason, he said, if you have gay sex, you burn for eternity. But then he leaves it there. This is a God who is opening up doorways into hell, not shutting them. This is the God you present to me, Christians, is a God who has completely abandoned us and is trying to get us to hell. Non-belief is another one. God could have made belief in him innate to us as hunger or thirst, and he didn't. He instead made heaven or hell dependent on accepting the absurd. Now, what Christians will say is, God wants you to have the choice to reject him or not. But that's not the same as the choice to believe in him. It's like Greta Christina always says, I believe the police are there because I have all kinds of evidence. It would be stupid of me not to. I can still choose whether or not to obey the law. God would be the same way. He doesn't need this mystery. He doesn't need to hide himself from us. Once again, this is a God who has abandoned us. If God's existence is a more important fact than the existence of the police, we should have more evidence for his existence than the existence of the police. But we don't. The moment a Christian realizes that they would feed a starving child or that they would alleviate some kind of suffering, they have immediately realized that they would make the world different than God. They're asserting that they can do better. They could conceive of a better world than the one God made. And if you're a Christian who believes that, it's time to leave. No all-knowing God could do better than you. No matter how brilliant you might be as a mortal, you're not all-knowing. It makes no sense to say that you could do better than God. I'm not asking much of Christians. I'm really not. But I am asking for consistency. And if you wouldn't worship a man who turned his back to the suffering of the poor, the suffering of the destitute, and the pain of starving children, don't worship the God who has made it his policy. Just don't do it. We always hear from Christians, look around you at how perfect the world is, that everything in existence speaks to God's perfection. But the minute we invent satellite weather radar, we're admitting that the way God made the world isn't perfect. The minute we figure new ways to farm to produce more food so less people will starve, we're asserting that the world is not perfect. And that's okay. Because we have this. We don't need God to look out for us. It's like I said on the steps of the Capitol today. Every human innovation is a testament to the uselessness of prayer and God's unwillingness to help us. And if that resonates with you as a Christian, just leave. You don't need it. There are several reasons a Christian will give to stay in church or to keep believing in God, even though all of this might resonate with them. You'll hear Christians say, well, yes, maybe it's all irrational, but my beliefs changed my life. And I used to be all hung up on drugs, and now I'm all hung up on the Lord. Heard that one? I believe you. I believe every Christian who says that. What they need to realize is that all beliefs have the power to change your life, not just the true ones. If I thought that there is a monster under my bed who is going to gnaw my legs off of the knee if I didn't donate $100 a week to charity, I'm going to become a charitable person. I like my knees where they are. But it says nothing to the existence of the monster under my bed. So even though your beliefs have changed your life, that doesn't mean that they're true. And if what I said earlier matters to you about having reasonable beliefs to make sure that our good intentions are borne out, that should mean something to you. It should mean more to you that the means you use to arrive at your beliefs are important and reliable than that you just hold a particular belief. Now, the next thing you'll hear from religious people is, from whence comes the universe, if not by God? I mean, look at it. It's all ordered and complex. Doesn't complexity require a designer? She's shaking her head no. She's right. Complexity in the universe doesn't require a designer. In fact, there was once a time when literally nothing was explained. And ever since that time, literally everything we have explained has been found to be the product of mindless forces acting upon inanimate objects. All of it. Take stars for existence. God didn't make them all on the fourth day. In fact, stars are still being made at places like the Orion Nebula. But you don't need a designer to create complexity there. All you need is a cloud of hydrogen that's so big it has enough mass to produce gravity. At that point, it'll pull itself together. The pressure in the center will spike, which will shoot the temperature through the roof. And through a process called the genes instability, you'll wind up with a far more ordered, far more complex star, with no appeal to God being necessary. And this is how everything we've explained works. And what's more, consider all the times where we've had a religious answer to a problem and it's turned out to be wrong. I mean, just think about it. Can you think of a time we had a religious answer to a problem that has since been replaced by a scientific answer? Geocentricity, done. They should come flooding into your head. Now try to think of a scientific answer we ever had that got replaced by a religious one. Exactly, right? Science has done nothing but erode religion since its conception, and it continues to do so. Lightning. Not the punishment of an angry god. Mindless forces acting upon inanimate objects. The same with earthquakes. You guys have heard William Lane Craig's Kalam argument, right? Some people didn't nod. You guys are the fortunate ones. It makes me want to vomit blood every time I hear it. But just consider how this would have worked with earthquakes before we figured out how they worked. You know, it would be something to the tune of, something has to be moving the ground, and matter doesn't move itself, so somewhere there must be an intelligent ground mover, right? Well, yes, until we discovered plate tectonics. Now, we haven't explained everything. But if everything we've ever explained has been found to be the product of natural forces, how do you think all the rest are going to turn out? I mean, imagine you've had two boxers that have fought millions of fights, with one boxer always beating the other. And they're about to fight again, and you have to bet your life savings on one. Every Christian in the world would bet on the winner until it comes to Christianity, where human beings are ignorant, we are less happy. With knowledge, we have changed the world into a veritable utopia compared to every generation before us. Ignorance is anathema to human well-being, but that's where God has left the Christian. That's the last argument he's given them. We don't know X, therefore God. God could have done better for you. He could have given you every advantage in this argument, and this is the best he's given you. This is the most someone's a Doctor Who fan. This is the most popular version of the argument from ignorance. Paley's Watchmaker argument. How it goes is, if someone who'd never been exposed to modern life was walking along a beach and found a watch in the sand and opened it up and saw it had gears and all these things that made it work, he would rightly conclude that somewhere out there there's a watchmaker. Well, the world has all of these laws and things that make it work. Surely somewhere out there there's a world maker. But there's a couple problems with this. The first is, God didn't just make the watch, according to the Christian. He made the sand it was buried in. He made the ocean. He made the grass. In fact, the metaphor would be more accurate if you said you found a watch on a beach of watches next to an ocean of watches and a universe full of watches, picked up that watch and looked and said, this one, this is designed. We can only see design in that context compared to what's behind it. The other fault with it, I'll get to that in a second. But first I want to talk about, for the Christians out there, how much ignorance can really impact your happiness. You might say that your beliefs have changed your life, even though they're irrelevant. But my assertion is that being reasonable and trying to gain as much knowledge as you can change your life in ways that inaccurate beliefs never could, no matter how cloying and happiness-inducing they are. When I was young, I've always been a huge fan of astronomy. Even when I was young and a Christian, I grew up in Crumrod, Arkansas. It's not really called Crumrod, but that's a more accurate name for it. I usually say Bumblefuck, but there's kids in the room. I grew up in Arkansas where there was no light pollution, and I could lay out every night under the stars, and I spent whole summers doing this. And I thought to myself that the stars were not only so beautiful, but incredibly meaningful to me, because I was experiencing God's handiwork. God made the stars, and I was, in a sense, communing with him through his creation. Sure, scientists were learning what made the stars burn, but they're learning how God did it, and that's all that really mattered. And they were so beautiful to me. And then I went to college, and I audited astronomy courses, and I learned about the genes instability, and I learned how to think of the size of the universe in terms of logarithmic functions that could convey a size that my brain couldn't even imagine on its own. And then I went home for the summer and I looked at the stars again. And I saw so much more. And there was so much more beautiful to me knowing how they actually worked. And I realized that before I took those courses, I was ignorant about what made the stars burn. I was ignorant about how the universe worked. But because I had given a name to my ignorance, God, I had come to admire and cherish my ignorance. And I was wrong. And that took a lot of the beauty out of me. So when you say your beliefs make you happy, I believe you. But I think reason and knowledge will make you even happier. Here's a fun argument. I did this argument last year when I came here. We've all heard you can't prove God doesn't exist. A real easy rebuttal is you can't prove Smurfs don't exist. But I find religious people have heard this so often that they think, yeah, but God is real and Smurfs aren't, is a good response. It's not, but they think it is. When you're talking to religious people, a lot of times it's good to come up with something a little unorthodox that kind of takes them off their script. So when someone says to me, you can't prove God doesn't exist, I want to try to get them to play by conventional logic rather than religious logic. Right? So when I hear, you can't prove God doesn't exist, the next words out of my mouth are, you're a thief. I say, what? I say, you're a thief. You steal shit. Stop doing it. That's bad. They say, well, I'm not a thief. I say, well, prove you're not a thief. And the next words out of their mouth are invariably, well, there's no evidence that I'm a... But it makes them think. You know, try to come up with quick stuff like that that might be something they haven't heard yet, because that's how you get the cogs to turn. Here's a fun one. I'm hearing Dan Barker groan in his head because he does debates, and this is the new hotness amongst apologists right now. To explain moral rules, don't we need God? If moral rules exist, don't we need a moral lawgiver? Nope. This quote was alluded to earlier. It's probably the only time I'll ever disagree with a Nobel laureate about anything. This is the Steven Weinberg quote. With or without it, you'd have good people doing good things and bad people doing bad things, but for good people to do evil things, that takes religion. And I don't think it's true. I think, like in the example with the parents praying their children to death, it just takes bad ideas. And religion is not the only place where bad ideas can reside. But in order for good people to do bad things, I think they need, you know, one of a couple things. They need to be ignorant of the facts, and it's not just religion that causes that. Or they need to have made a virtue out of being unreasonable. And that's the one I pin on religion. Even the liberal religious people. If you believe that someone rose from the dead, you are not making your best effort to be reasonable. Even if you think your beliefs are completely personal and don't affect everybody else, you're still failing your obligation to be reasonable. Now, how does this relate to morality? Well, what you'll get in response to those two things from religious people is, well, you can't get an ought from an is, so therefore we need a moral lawgiver since we can't figure out the ought from an is by ourselves. But you can get an ought from an is. In fact, we do it all the time. For instance, if you want to smell good, you ought to take a shower. Now, a couple things have to be true. You must want to be clean, and the shower must not have some other deleterious effect like melting off your skin. But as long as those things are true, you want to be clean, and a shower will get you clean, then the is-ought statement is true. You ought to take a shower. You do this in your day all the time. If you want your car to run well, you ought to change the oil. So in order to figure out what we ought to do in terms of morality, we have to figure out what we want. What desire is morality, is moral rules satisfying for us? And even religious people think this way. For instance, you have to want to follow God. This is why religions like Christianity try to come up with a heaven that everybody wants to go to and a hell that nobody wants to go to. And you can even test them on this. You can ask them, if you found out today that obeying the Ten Commandments landed you in hell and disobeying them got you to heaven, how would your behavior change? And every time I've asked a Christian this, they always say, well, I would start breaking the Ten Commandments. I start killing my neighbors, raping their pets, and stealing their pornography, because that's what would get me into heaven. Right? And this is how they try to appeal to you. You know, you want to go to heaven, so you ought to follow the Ten Commandments, but what if I want to go to hell? What ought I to do then? It all goes down to what we want. So what do we want in terms of morality? What desires are moral rules satisfying in us? And it's a pretty simple answer. We all want to be happy. Am I right? This is why we all have jobs we hate, because we'd rather have a roof over our head and food in our stomachs, even though we have to get up at 6 in the morning and go to work every day. There are certain things that make us more happy than other things. The golden rule: do unto others as you would have done unto you. This creates a world where more people are happy. That's why it's morally true, not because Jesus or 20,000 people before him said it. What we need to realize then is that we share happiness and unhappiness. Smiles are contagious. When we see blood in horror movies, a lot of us recoil. We share the experiences of the people around us. So it's in our interest to make everybody happy and create a world where people don't have to worry about having their things stolen from them. That is all the basis we need for creating moral rules. The realization that without moral rules, the world would suck. And at that point, that's all we need to make them up. Now, it won't be perfect, but nothing ever is. We can only make the world a better place, not really a utopian one. So what are some good ideas for moral rules? Well, generosity makes a better world. Being responsible, smiles of others, not killing or oppressing one another. This is all the basis we need for morality, not God, not threats of hell, and we certainly don't need the God that said in Exodus 35:2 to kill everybody who works on a Saturday. Even if we needed a moral lawgiver, that's not the one we need. All right, so here's this one. You ever heard this one? How is reason even possible without God if our brains are only unthinking matter and atoms? You know, how do we even have thoughts? Well, first off, even if I had no idea, that doesn't mean that you do. My ignorance is not tantamount to your knowledge. But there's an easy answer for this. Here are a bunch of pieces of unthinking matter arranged in a particular way that can't perform logic and can't think, but arrange that unthinking matter in the proper way, and all of a sudden it can perform logic, and it can figure out that it wants one result more than another. Yeah, crazy, right? So unthinking matter can perform logical functions if arranged in a proper way, like a computer or a brain. Now, what you get from the Christian next is, mwahaha, computers don't build themselves, so brains must have a designer somewhere, right? Well, no. It turns out, the reason paintings don't paint themselves, and buildings don't build themselves, and computers don't build themselves, is because they're not made of molecules that self-replicate. Human beings, on the other hand, are. That is exactly what DNA does. It self-replicates. And anytime you have these three forces in place, you will get improved functionality over time. It's reproduction, mutation, and selection. This is why our bodies and brains were able to improve in terms of functionality in this environment over time, and why we don't need a designer for them. The next thing you'll hear is, but if reason's only the product of unthinking matter, how do we know we can trust it? Right? Well, if not by reason, then by what? If you use the word because when giving an answer, you lose. And if you don't have something better, well, then just stick with reason like you do for everything else. If you haven't come to belief in Jesus by reason, how worthwhile is that belief? Even the liberal Christians will want to say, whenever something terrible happens, you know, whenever a religious person does something terrible, those beliefs aren't my beliefs. My beliefs are different. I believe your beliefs are different. But if your beliefs are no more likely to be true, you've lost the ability to say that they're wrong. And if your beliefs are no more likely to be true than the people who you're denigrating, that should mean something to you. It should be offensive to you. It should be relevant to you. I hate this guy. This man poisons the minds of children. Have you seen the videos on YouTube of Ken Ham with rooms full of children teaching them what to say to their science teachers? Were you there? And it's not just kids. I hear this from adults. Adults use this. I wish I could do this. Take a second, read it. We determine what happened when we weren't there all the time. If you come home and there are tire tracks in your front yard, and your door is kicked in, and all of your electronics are missing, and you call the police and say, "Police, my house was robbed," are they really gonna say, "Were you there?" You're gonna say, "No, but there's all this evidence." And they'll say, "Well, I'm sorry, if you weren't there, it might very well have been pixies. We don't know." Your robbery thing is just a theory. Ever had a Christian say this to you? "God speaks to me"? Well, let's talk about that. On your left, we have Abraham. On the right, we have Andrea Yates. Andrea Yates heard the voice of God tell her to drown her 3 children, and she obeyed. Abraham heard the voice of God telling him to gut his son, and he obeyed. Now, Christians will scream until they're blue in the face that Andrea Yates couldn't have been a true Christian. Why not? I mean, obviously it can't be that God would never tell someone to kill their child. What's more, to you Christians, who may not be buying this religious thing completely anymore, I'm really speaking to you here. You're the ones who take your children to Sunday school and listen to them tell your children how Abraham is a perfect example of a Christian. He heard God speak and obeyed, even though the command was terrible. So did she. And you're the one who leaves Sunday school and goes into the sermon and listens to the pastor tell everybody that Christianity is the source of all moral rules, and that it's atheists who have no moral compass. There are plenty of people just like Andrea. Daphne Spurlock heard God tell her to slit her son's throat, and she obeyed. The answer is very simple to this conundrum. Despite what you might be told in church, Abraham failed the moral test. Even if God really existed, and he really came to Andrea and Daphne and Abraham and said, "I want you to kill your children," even if that God was real, the proper answer is unequivocally no. If you're generous, more realistic answer would be, "I'd rather go to hell." And if you realize that even wicked commandments from a God should be refused, then you are already coming up with the moral rules yourself. You are the one who reads the barbarity in the Old Testament and decides, "No, this was never moral." And if you're capable of making those moral judgments for yourself, you don't need the Bible. You don't need a religious leader feeding you your moral rules. And for those Christians who think God speaks to them and you think Christianity is the only true religion, just think about how this looks for everybody else who has thought God spoke to them. He didn't speak to these people. They were either lying, deluded, or crazy. Ditto for these people. And these, and these, and these, and these. All of them sincerely thought that God was speaking to them and were somehow wrong. Is it so crazy to think that there's not just one special group that God is really talking to you to, but if pretty much everybody who ever thought God was speaking to them has been lying, deluded, or crazy, why not all of them? Why are Christians immune to the same flaw in human psychology that has produced all these other erroneous faiths? And the answer is simple. You're not. You might believe that God speaks to you, but just consider it in the context of every other believer ever. "But I feel God. When I pray, I feel euphoric. I get all these fuzzy feelings. And I feel God is there." And I think you're being sincere, but I think you've the Christians who say this have made the wrong conclusions from feelings they actually have. Our senses aren't always completely reliable. Take this image. Square A and square B are the exact same color. Check this out. Right? Now, I've done this before, and they've said, well, the block changed colors as it went by. Try it this way. They're the same color. But even when I take them away, they'll still look like a different color to you. Because sometimes our senses aren't always reliable, and sometimes our thinking isn't always proper. Now, we know people can be wrong about religion, thinking completely that they're right. Could it not be that these feelings of euphoria you get when you pray are just naturally what happens when you think there's a friend in the room, or when you think you're talking to God? Is that not a more viable explanation than our flawed senses? I mean, our flawed senses are how magicians make their living, right? I used to be a magician. I used to keep two rubber bands on my wrist for when Christians gave me the I sense God argument. And I'd take them out and do a trick where it looks like the rubber bands melt through each other. And I'd say to them, you just saw those rubber bands melt through each other. Do you immediately believe in magic? Or do you just assume there's a natural explanation? Well, when you get fuzzy feelings when you pray, do you just assume it's magic? Or is the right thing to do to assume there's a natural explanation for what's going on? And once again, the answer is simple. So consider all the ways that you should defer to reality like you do with magic. People don't rise from the dead. It doesn't happen. Anybody telling you otherwise without sufficient evidence is mistaken. People don't walk on water. If you think otherwise, submit it to a peer review in physics and watch how they laugh at you. Prayer is a crapshoot, or God is malicious. God will help people find their keys when they pray or find their missing sock, but will ignore the prayers of starving children. If prayer is not a crapshoot, God's a dick. Biblical barbarity was never moral. I mean, when you cite things like Exodus 35:2, kill everybody who works on a Saturday, what you'll get from Christians is that Jesus came along and changed it and made it better. I don't think they understand that what they're really saying is that at one time that was the right thing to do. How can good people have their moral senses so twisted like that? And the answer is bad ideas about the universe and being so committed to those bad ideas that you'll do anything to defend them. I don't say this to Christians. I say it because I think Christians are better than that. I think everybody is better than that. I think you can do so much better than defending immorality by saying that Jesus changed it, and so therefore it was okay at one point. Nobody could survive in the belly of a fish for 3 days. People don't get converted into pillars of salt. Once again, I don't ask for much, but I do ask for consistency. And even Christians act and behave like the universe is consistent. If a Christian walks by an oven 1 week and burns their hand on it, they're not going to put their hand on the stove the next week because they assume the universe is consistent. And this goes across the board. They don't leave their house by the second story window. They leave by the front door. This is how they live until it gets to people rising from the dead. You're better than that. And I want to treat you like you're better than that. The atheist movement wants to treat you like you're better than that. There's a catch-all, though. No matter how irrational it is, there's always this. I have faith. Sure, people don't ordinarily rise from the dead, but I have faith. And to that, my question is always this. Can you distinguish faith from gullibility for me? Right? Nobody wants to be gullible, but a lot of people want to have faith. Just think about it. Is there any truth claim so ludicrous, so flagrantly at odds with reality, that faith couldn't be used to defend it? If this is what can be used to defend any harebrained idea, and your religious beliefs are the most important thing in your life, shouldn't you be able to do better than faith? Yes. What about love? I mean, we have no evidence for love, right? It's invisible. You can't touch it. You still believe it's there. Well, God is love. Well, love is a state of the brain. When the brain is in a particular configuration, you have feelings. And the way we determine that is how people act. We believe happiness exists. It's a state of the brain because when people are happy, they smile and laugh. When people are sad, they cry and they frown. And when people are in love, they behave a certain way. Belief in God is a state of the brain. And not even the most ardent atheist will ever say that belief in God doesn't exist. Lord knows it does. But God is not a state of the brain. God is something tangible, like this podium. And if the existence of God is a more important fact than the existence of this podium, why can I touch this? That is a God who has abandoned you. Don't worship that God, even if he does exist. This is my message to you, Christians, even the moderate Christians, even the liberal Christians, the ones sitting in the pews and realizing that a bunch of the arguments in this talk make sense. I know what it's like to be in your position, even if you don't believe it. I understand what it's like to be sitting in a church and thinking I had to be there in order to have a social life in whatever part of the country I'm in. I did it in high school. I understand what it feels like to worry that if people around you found out that you would lose friends or even be ostracized from your family. Lots of people in this room knows what it feels like to be so afraid that someone will find out what you really are, because then you might lose a job when your manager is a religious person. We know what it's like to feel that fear. But what you need to understand is this is how religion lives. This is how religion has always lived. I'm from Arkansas, remember? Now, if you drive a fair way on the interstate down there, you will see countless billboards saying, if you don't believe in Jesus, you're going to burn. Come to our church. You will see no billboards saying, we have evidence. Come to our church. That's because religion lives on keeping people afraid. That's why these social consequences exist. And I understand that you are afraid. The atheist movement understands that you are afraid. And I'm not going to tell you there's not a reason to be, because there is. And churches and our religious society are largely to blame for that. But what I will say to you is, you're no longer at the point. Society is no longer at the point where if you left that church, where they tell your children that a man who would kill his child was the moral example for all of humanity, if you want to get out, you can, and there will be help. If you go on meetup.com, there are atheist groups in virtually every city in this country right now. There's an atheist group there that is willing to accept you as you truly are. If you are the type who has never touched someone that you love in the way that you want, because there's these archaic rules forbidding you to, we'll still take you. We want you to live in all the ways that are going to make you happy. Come to us. Take our hand, because we want to help and we're there for you. You don't have to stay there anymore. And the last thing I'll say to atheists, at least the atheists who say things like this, why bother arguing? It's not like religious people ever change their minds. Atheists that say this need to be punched square in the nuts. When I hear this, it drives me up a tree, and I'll tell you why. This completely takes all the responsibility away from you. It assumes that you were perfect in your presentation, you communicated perfectly, and it's just that the religious person was so closed-minded. Don't do that. Learn from your mistakes. Change your approach. This room is full of believers who had their minds changed. How many of you used to be a believer? Everybody raise your hand if you were. Leave your hands in the air. Now leave your hand in the air if an argument from someone, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, or a friend, helped you get out of it. Almost everybody. Strange, right? Remember what I said earlier. We don't choose our beliefs. Whatever facts are in our mind dictate our beliefs, which is why deconversions usually happen slowly and against someone's will, and worrying every night that they're going to wind up in hell for these doubts that they can't help. Once the right facts get into someone's mind, they are powerless to do different. And the way we do that is by talking to them and arguing with them. Now, you may not be the type to argue with religious people, and that's okay. Like Greta said, there's a million different ways you can do your activism. But for all the atheists out there who would talk me out of trying to argue with religious people, you can go straight to hell, because I'm not going to do it. And neither should any other atheist who thinks that the accuracy of ideas matter. Not only that it matters, that it's a moral responsibility to do what you can to make sure people are reasonable, whether they're fundamentalist Christians, whether they're moderate Christians, whether they're Muslims, liberal Christians. because each of us has that obligation to be reasonable. And when people are running around, no matter how nice they are, spreading the idea that it's okay to believe in things for bad reasons, they are greasing the gears of the mechanism that provides the outlet for fundamentalists to do the evil they do. I can't criticize fundamentalist religion without also criticizing the faith that drives liberal religion. But that's only part of it. The rest of it is what you guys do. How many of you guys in here are activists? Are you part of a community group? Do you run a community group? Do you argue with people online? Do you talk to religious people about their beliefs? You guys are the heroes. There's a huge disconnect in this movement between the people like me who are up on stage and the people like you out there. There's this idea that, you know, we're the leaders and you guys are the followers. No, we're all working at this. You guys are just enjoying a different role than I am. I look up to you guys. You guys are the ones making the difference. And you guys are the reason that the people who are in the pews questioning are going to be able to come out. And I'm so grateful to you. Thank you.